going to go ahead in the interest of staying on time and get started. My name is Carol Golan. I'm from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I've been asked to introduce the Gary Reeder and Andrew Kaplan Memorial Lecture, as well as our esteemed lecturer, Bob Ramian. So I am just so proud to introduce this Gary Reeder and Andrew Kaplan Memorial Lecture, which was created by IAPAC, for those of you who don't know, to honor two special colleagues who dedicated their careers to applying innovative strategies to battle the HIV epidemic and to bring a humane perspective to the science of HIV. And that's why selecting Robert Ramian and the title of his talk, Ending AIDS, Considering the Human Element, is such an appropriate way to honor the memories of Gary and Andy. Now, while I didn't know Gary Reeder, need to advance here a little bit. While I didn't know Gary Reeder very well, and I didn't really know him personally, I knew him by reputation as a very astute and devoted clinician and HIV researcher. And Andy Kaplan, though, as some of you know, was my husband. And so I'm particularly proud and grateful to the committee that this conference has chosen to honor and remember him and Gary together. I was asked to provide a personal perspective to introducing this lectureship. So I'm going to try to do that, but I'm also going to try to be brief so that we have plenty of time to hear from Bob. As clinicians, scientists in training in the 1980s, which is when Gary and Andy both trained, they were each among the first group of clinicians and researchers confronted with the HIV epidemic. And this brought them into contact with AIDS patients while they were training at a time when little was known and treatment didn't exist. So both the need and the challenge drew each of them to this emerging field. Both of them were men who had great energy and compassion, and they devoted this to caring for segments of society that often fell through the cracks of the healthcare system and through the cracks of society in general. And both men were also known as very brilliant mentors to many younger investigators. Gary's devotion was reflected in the fact that he helped establish Holyoke's first HIV clinic and Holyoke Health Center's HIV programs, while also turning his attention to humane palliative and end-of-life care for HIV-infected patients, and spreading knowledge of HIV around the globe to reduce its stigma and its discrimination. As one of his colleagues put it, he took away the fear people had about AIDS here. He turned individuals with AIDS into people who were merely living with a sickness. He was described as an innovator when it came to the treatment of AIDS, and a candle in the dark, illuminating the injustice of HIV stigmatization. He was also known to be a tireless advocate for his patients, an effective teacher, forward-thinking administrator, and devoted father. Like Gary, Andy also had an innovative mind full of curiosity. As a medical resident, when I first met him, as an example, he became known for his ardent interest in infectious diseases because he got a kick out of showing off on rounds his encyclopedic knowledge of obscure infections affecting humans. Ultimately, though, he honed in infectious diseases because fellowship to work in a lab to study the molecular biology of the HIV protease. Sorry, I'm going to go back for a second. While he started out enjoying a career as a successful wet bench researcher, his breadth of intellect and interest in public health resurfaced in 1999 during a molecular biology conference dinner in Palm Springs, where everyone was talking about these new cocktails. And it wasn't the cocktails we were having for dinner. It was these new medicines, combination medicines that used these regimens with protease inhibitors, these new protease inhibitors. So as a general internist studying diabetes, self-care, I was a bit appalled, and I was asking, well, what will it actually be like for patients to take these medicines, these complicated regimens? Will there be side effects? Will they be able to adhere? And when we were told that these early trials had not considered these issues yet, Andy's response to me was, let's write a grant together. And we did, which led each of us to focus much of our research that followed on ARV adherence and access to care. Andy focusing more on the molecular aspects and I focusing more on the behavioral. Then in the last few years of Andy's scholarly breadth became more fully apparent, as did his role as a mentor and collaborator when he provided senior leadership to a novel set of studies following the impact on behavior, therapy, and care of incarcerated persons who returned to their communities, gaining himself the nickname of the social worker. And as you can see by some of the wide variety of publications ranging from molecular to behavioral, his interests were very broad. And even at this conference today, you'll see several presentations of mentees of his that grew out of that work. Last, on a personal note, those of you in the audience who knew him, maybe from study section, will remember him as a person who was very funny, a loyal Yankees fan, a fanatical runner, a zealous foodie, and like Gary Reeder, he was also a loving family man who worked hard to balance career and family. So given these aspects of Gary and Andy, it's with particular honor that I introduce Robert Remien, and that he has been selected to give this lecture in their memory. Dr. Remien is a professor of clinical psychology and director of the HIV Center for Clinical and Behavioral Studies at the New York State Psychiatric Institute and the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University. Dr. Remien has been involved in HIV volunteer work, clinical work, he still even has a private practice, community mobilization, and advocacy since the early 1980s, and he has developed a large and diverse portfolio of domestic and international research projects focused on the intersection of prevention and care. Sounds like this meeting, right? And he's looked specifically at HIV testing, linkage and retention in care, adherence to treatment, and prevention with positives. His research includes the development and testing of evidence-based behavioral interventions. He is the clinical director of a lot of different organizations and serves on many distinguished review panels and advisory groups, so I'm not going to name them all. But I did want to mention, I noticed that one of these includes the New York State Governor's Ending the Epidemic Task Force, which I thought was pretty cool. Perhaps one of the most salient examples of Bob's great compassion and humanity as an HIV researcher that's near and dear to this conference in particular are the many years that he's devoted to the beloved patient panel that's presented session at the HIV Adherence Conference each year. And he actually initiated the very first patient panel at the second IAPAC Adherence Conference in 2007 in Jersey City, New Jersey, for those of you who were there who remember that one. And he then moderated the panel up through 2013. So I think we're very fortunate to have Bob here to speak with us today. And I, for one, am very much looking forward to hearing what he has to share with us. So please join me in welcoming Bob Remien.
Thank you all. Good morning. And thank you, Carol, for that very gracious and wonderful introduction, and especially for your introduction of Gary and Andy. I'm really honored to be here, to be asked to give this lecture. So I really want to thank the conference organizers, especially Jose and Reve and Muggs. It really is an honor to be here. And as Carol said, you know, in memory of Gary and Andy, I thought it'd be fitting to title this talk, Ending AIDS, Considering the Human Element, because they were examples of the human experience and being pioneers early in the field addressing the HIV epidemic. And also, as Carol mentioned, what I'm weaving into this talk is my own personal and professional experience in working in HIV/AIDS, because I did start working in the community and working in HIV/AIDS in the early 80s, before the virus was even named and discovered, or the disease was even named. So a lot of you in the audience will, I think, appreciate some of the history I'm going to bring forward. I see a lot of young faces, and some of this history may be new to some of you. But in terms of where we are today in 2016, we've come a long way since the early 80s in terms of HIV and AIDS. We have a wide range of potent regimens, new emerging treatments, long-acting injectables, cure research agenda. People are living longer. It's seen as a chronic disease. We have PrEP, topical, oral. So there's a lot of talk about the end of AIDS. And is that hyper hope, which is kind of a question running through a lot of our minds. We've been hearing a lot about all these initiatives, the 90-90-90. We heard a lot yesterday about Fast Track and the U.S. National HIV/AIDS Strategy. There are a lot of more local examples, as was just mentioned, in New York State. There are other states, other jurisdictions, and cities. Even our political leaders are talking about an AIDS-free generation. Can we achieve it? I think history is always a good lesson, and we should remind ourselves of the history and where we've come since this epidemic started. And think about what adherence was back in the early 80s. What were people adhering to? There were many, many years of experimental treatments and a lot of activists and advocates working hard to bring about these kinds of things. But people were adhering to nutritional supplements, things like egg lecithin that people were experimenting with. Keeping nutrition up through Hickman catheters. And of course, what was so important in the early days was preventive medicine for opportunistic infections, prophylaxis, like the aerosolized pentamidine. I remember being at this community forum in 1988. So even in some of the darkest days, when so many people were getting sick and dying, this was announced by a well-known community physician at a large community forum in Manhattan. He said, my guess is that within 12 to 18 months, we will be able to arrest the disease at whatever stage it is at, except for people who are extremely sick. And by that time, we will be able to begin to restore immune function back toward normal. The prediction was 12 to 18 months in 1988. As we know, that didn't turn out to be true, not then. The epidemic raged on, and deaths continued. And it felt endless for so many of us, both domestically here in the United States and across the globe, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where there was just tremendous loss, grief. In fact, those of us who were doing research in these days, particularly if we had anything to do with psycho or social science, I'd say the first third of my publications and research were all about coping with loss, coping with multiple loss and grief, and looking for psychological resilience in the context of such a devastating epidemic. And a lot of us had many, many personal losses. So these are a smattering of some people I knew. And I know I'm not alone in this room. I know there are people here who experience a lot of personal loss. And if I were to actually name and show pictures of all the people I knew who we lost, it would use up the rest of my time. And again, I know I'm not alone in that experience. So AZT was the first drug to come along. And it showed some promise, and there was some excitement. It was the first drug that showed it was actively working against HIV virus. But as many of you know, the monotherapy had some effect, but ultimately did not keep most people alive. So fast forward, 1996, which is why we are here today, we have combination antiretroviral therapy. And this was very, very exciting. I don't know how many people were at the Montreal conference in 1996. Wow. Fewer than I thought. It was a very, very exciting time that we actually had combination therapy. However, there were many, many years of confusion and lack of clarity about when to start. Many even know there was a pendulum that swung back and forth. Hit hard, hit early, With heart or preserve, wait and preserve your options. What combination to start with as more and more drugs were coming out? It was recognized fairly quickly in those early years of therapy that there were a lot of concerns about toxicities, particularly with the regimens we were first starting with, and concerns about drug resistance. So this was a point in time, this article by Larry Altman in the New York Times, when there were about 15 drugs in our armamentarium. And still at that point, the scientists were saying, we need new and better drugs because of drug resistance, because of toxicities. Medical care for many, many years, and some might say even today, was as much an art as it was a science. New agents coming on the market, what's the role, ongoing role of prophylaxis against opportunistic infections? What's the role of, at this time, newly approved viral load test? How should that be used in treatment and care? There was basically a lack of data. And as the headline in this article in JMHC Treatment Issues titled, Flying by the Seat of Our Pants. And that's what a lot of us felt like we were doing. So literally, this is me flying by the seat of my pants. Sorry, I couldn't resist. And I highly recommend it for anyone who hasn't done it. It's pretty exciting. But here we are today. We have the use of antiretrovirals for prevention as well as for treatment. Many of you have seen this slide, so I'm going to go through very quickly. We do have, the goal is combination HIV treatment, right? HIV prevention and treatment. And they are one and the same. So we have all these tools in our toolbox. And I will say, as a behavioral scientist, I'm excited, like I think many of us are, that we have all these tools, that we have something to implement and scale up. And it's where the behavioral and social science comes in terms of implementing and scaling up all these tools in our toolbox. So it is exciting. It's what leads us, and also these kind of predictions and these models that say if we really, really, truly implement the combination package that we have, can we bring this epidemic down? And Ruby Granich, who I believe is in the audience, who we heard a lot from yesterday, has been one of the leaders in modeling this kind of thing and leading us towards this notion of a worldwide call to mobilize and focus on ending AIDS. We have, and you heard in detail, I'm just going to re-mention these things, the very exciting work that IAPAC is leading with the Fast Track Cities initiative. It's very exciting that we now have 65 cities on board, and I think, week by week, there are more cities coming on board. So very exciting. As was mentioned, ending the epidemic in New York State, I was proud and pleased, along with some other people who are in the audience here, in New York to serve on the governor's task force. It was a lot of work doing that work. Bruce Agins yesterday talked about the three pillars of that, so I'm not going to go over these, but you see them there as a reminder. We did a lot of work for about 9 months where people came together. We held many community forums. Hundreds of recommendations were made from various communities. We brought the blueprint down to 30 recommendations, including 7 getting to 0 recommendations. And the governor's been behind this. I'm proud that I'm continue to be on the AIDS Advisory Council committee that is sort of looking at how this initiative is being implemented and scaled up. So it's an exciting time. And again, as you've heard, there are other jurisdictions in the United States and, of course, globally where people are making this effort. I want to remind us, though, step back a little bit, that, we've been on a positive trajectory for over a decade. So whether we look at numbers of new infections in infants and children as well as adults or the number of AIDS-related deaths, all of them have been going down for the last 10, 11 years, which is good news. But as Ambassador Birx pointed out yesterday, there's still so much more to do. Are we happy with 2.3, whether it's 2.1, 2.3, 2.5 million new infections a year? Of course we're not. And she pointed out nicely are we going to stabilize that or are we going to even decrease it further? So there's a lot of work ahead, but we've been on this trajectory. So I think with the impetus of things like the cities initiative and all these ending the epidemic initiatives, I think it's about accelerating this. I think it's about bending the curve faster. But look how many people we're dealing with who are living with HIV throughout the world. There's just a lot of people to get treatment to. And here you can see percentages, and even though these data are a little bit old, there's Overall, 36% of people living with HIV globally. We see the range here from, I think it's like 15% up to 50% being the highest. There's a lot of work. And I'm, the rest of my comments are focused more on the treatment for people living with HIV. So this is a paper that I'm quite proud of that I wrote with my friend and colleague, Claude Mellins, who's here today. I'm totally supportive of all of the structural interventions and policy and law changes that are needed to help end the epidemic. But while doing that, we must not forget the individual in our global response to the epidemic, because it comes down to individuals. It comes down to behavior. Ambassador Birx talked about that yesterday and mentioned a few times about putting the human faces behind the numbers. So you're hearing a lot of numbers at this conference. I want to talk about a little bit more about the humanity that's behind that and what's needed if we're really going to end the epidemic. So I would say this slide, the title of this paper, and my next slide are probably a summary of what my take-home message is to this audience. But I also think I'm preaching to the choir. You've all seen the treatment cascade. Thank you, Ed, and others. Forget about these numbers. That's not why I'm showing this. These are old numbers from the U.S., but what I want to highlight, which we've been already hearing about, and we're going to hear more about at this conference, about the disparities and the reality in our treatment cascade. So we know that, and this is a little more focused on the U.S., but a lot of these apply globally. Black MSM, worse outcomes at each step of the cascade. Young people doing worse at each step of the cascade. Specifically, heterosexual men and women and transgendered women compared to MSM overall and even compared to male IDUs. Lower efficacy at achieving these steps in the cascade. We have social and structural issues such as insurance, access to care, housing, food security, immigration status. We have more social issues. Social isolation versus social support. Stigma and discrimination. Then we have more at individual level, mental health issues, alcohol and substance use, domestic violence. What else do we have? As a psychologist, we have things like people's knowledge and risk perception, motivation to test, to be treated, to adhere, self-efficacy and management skills, instrumental and emotional support. And very importantly, and I want to focus on this for a few minutes, provider-patient communication, which I think is one of the key elements to the success. So the point of this, and why I say this is a summary of really my message to this audience today, is that there remains an urgent and vital behavioral, social science, i.e. human, agenda for each step in the cascade. And what I'm pleased to also notice is that when I look at the abstracts at this conference and the work that you all are doing, this is the work that we're doing. People are looking at all of these domains and all of these elements. I think the challenge is, you know, how do we do it all? How do we put it all together? Because all of these are active influencers and agents in our success along the treatment cascade. Another way of looking at it is the implementation cascade. Seek, test, link, treat, adhere, retain. Okay, this is the audience interaction part. This is a quick grammar quiz. What part of speech are these words? Correct, verbs. Which means behaviors. What kind of verbs? Action verbs. Requiring an action. Action on the part of who? Everyone, but I think particularly patients, people living with HIV, and their providers. So this is the heart of the work we do. This is why this conference exists. This is why I love this conference, why we all get to come together, because I think we all know this. But even if we go back before effective therapies and some of my early work on long-term survivors, there were, you know, a lot of questions why people who were told they had 6 months to a year to live were living 3 and more years, some of them 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years after they'd been given a death sentence. And a friend of mine and one of my heroes in the epidemic, some of you may know Michael Callan, who wrote this handbook on surviving and thriving with AIDS. That led a group of us at Columbia, at our HIV center, to do long-term survivor research. And some of my earliest work was in this domain. And we did identify psychological resilience, positive attitudes, the importance of maintaining goals in life, having a proactive coping style, being assertive in healthcare behaviors. As this Larry Altman article, again in the New York Times, survival of AIDS patients linked to experience of their doctors. We found this in our interviews with a large group of long-term survivors and the importance of the partnership with their medical provider. That led us to write this book. We did more interviews with not only the long-term survivors, but the providers who were treating them. And so that led to this book, Good Doctors, Good Patients, Partners in HIV Treatment. And some of the themes in that book are the matching styles of finding a provider you can work with, being involved in joint decision-making, being aggressively taking care and managing illness, while also balancing candor and hope, because the reality is this was in the early 90s when we did this work, before combination therapy. But this led to resilience and survival. Ultimately, of course, people succumbed to the virus because it was more powerful, but these were influencing factors. This also led to my looking at other ways of support, and this was, I'm pretty sure, the first NIMH study focused on serodiscordant male couples. And at this time, again, before effective therapies, it was really about coping and support partners in coping with progressive illness and ultimately death and dying. As Carol mentioned, I'm proud that I was started the patient panel back at the Second International Conference in 2007 in Jersey City. Muggs, even though I live close to Jersey, I kind of miss going there now and then too, because I don't often go across the river from New York City. But what I want to show you here on this is that this was one of several concurrent sessions. And you can see there were a lot of competition in terms of who else was on at the same time, including people like, who do I see here? Reve and Julie Arnston and other people who are here, Mike Sterrett. So there was a small audience at our first panel, and I remember these three women very fondly who were just very exciting, and it was a wonderful panel. What happened then is I was invited back to do it, the panel, from 2008 to 2011, again in concurrent sessions. And it grew and grew, and I guess there was some feedback, and I think the organizers of IRPAC and of the meeting elevated it to the main stage, which was really pretty exciting. In 2012, Mike Sterrett, thank you, as well as other IRPAC staff over time, helped me organize and invite the participants. And in 2013, of note, we had the first person who got up there and talked about PrEP and talked it in front of a scientific audience, which was new at the time. He even used a pseudonym at the time. I've been so pleased that the baton for this panel, I'm pleased that IAPAC maintains the panel. I'm pleased that the baton has been passed to two friends and colleagues and peers of mine, Phil Wilson and Moises Agosto, who will be leading the panel today. So I'm really pleased with that. And a theme of the panel was, we heard a lot about what influence linkage or retention and care, but a lot of the panelists talked about the importance of the provider-patient relationship, and then a lot of researchers, including people in this room, I won't mention, get everyone, but people particularly like Tom Giordano and Ira Wilson and others, where Dick Grimes, I'm glancing at the names, where research documented the importance and the role of provider-patient relationship. We recently published a paper and conducted a study in New York City that was focused on four populations who were highly vulnerable to falling out of care in New York City. And this is just a smattering of some of the quotes, which I'm not going to go through all of them for lack of time, but the fact that they talked a lot about needing a caring and compassionate provider who could be straight with them, who could they talk with, and would talk back very straight with them and have a relationship. And you see this from all of these four vulnerable groups: African immigrants, previously incarcerated, young MSM, and transgendered women. The providers who showed caring, concern, and compassion is what people felt were key for getting them back into care and or keeping them in care. Globally, it's recognized that there are more vulnerable populations. So I think if we think about, you know, the converse of the 90-90-90 will be the 10-10-10. And will we really work to get to where we need to get with the most highly vulnerable groups and the efforts that takes? We also recognize, and there's a lot of research from people in this room, and a lot of you will see names of people in this room on this, for the role of mental health and adherence, depression, other psychiatric conditions, substance use, alcohol use. And this is just a smattering, just examples of all the research being done in this area. Let me very quickly go through and just point out, not go in detail, the fact that we have guidance for what are effective ART adherence interventions. So we have this paper that was supported by IAPAC. Many of us were pleased to serve on this. It was a lot of work, but I think it was really important. I think it still holds up. I know there's an update coming, and we look forward to the update on these guidelines, but this is the first adherence guidelines, so I think they're really important. The CDC has their compendium of evidence-based interventions. Just want to flash these up because, again, principal investigators behind these interventions are people who have attended this conference over the years, and some of them are here today. These are just in alphabetical order, the name of the interventions. And then finally, back to my point, my slide about the cascade and all of the domains it's going to take, the most effective interventions, and Jane Simone and others have led some of the best meta-analyses, Reve as well, point to the need to person-to-person counseling interactions and addressing all of these domains that we think of in the cognitive behavioral literature. I want to just, in the last part of my talk, just mention some of the work that I'm involved in currently, because that I think is relevant to this topic I'm talking about. So I'm, along with a team, we're working in South Africa. Many of you have seen me present Masuva Kenny here. Sorry, my Rubio moment. At least I knew where it was. Whoops. So my only point about this, I just want to show images, I'm not getting into data, is that to do these interventions, the kind of work that I like to do is working with local providers and patients and counselors. And our focus here was to try and enhance the capability of what lay counselors can do through the use of multimedia. And the fact that you have to locally tailor. It was our local partners in South Africa who came up with these images. We started way top there on the left with this image that was mechanical, and we said, no, that doesn't even make sense to us. Showing the relationship between viral load, CD4 count, and opportunistic infections, and health and adherence. How do you say all that without a lot of words? They came up with this island metaphor and healthy, unhealthy. This is an interactive thing where people can see people's body change if they adhere and what happens to their viral load, et cetera. They wanted human figures. They wanted us, and we did, develop videos with people doing problem solving, providing support to each other. And the challenge, of course, is doing this in resource-constrained settings like the township you see here outside of Cape Town. And in the bottom center, you see one of our counselors in the middle just grabbing a space in these very busy clinics, which is the waiting room on the right, to just talk with the patient and the patient's buddy and to use this program to show them videos and show them things. Another project I'm involved in, and there are many people here in the room who are involved in this, HB10078, I'm co-chair with Chris Beyer, and we're working in four cities, Baltimore, Binghamton, Boston, and help me out, Alex, and Birmingham. Birmingham, and it's exciting because this is also in the realm of working with the community, doing tailoring. We're trying to find through deep chain RDS, to get to people, MSM, particularly young MSM, living with viral load in the community and bringing them into intensive case management that will be tailored to their needs, whether it's needs for mental health, housing, et cetera. Starting to wrap up a project in New York City, even though the title of this is a structural intervention, what we're really doing is providing support to providers and patients in community-based clinics in high-prevalence neighborhoods, mostly in the Bronx and Upper Manhattan, to recognize and screen for acute HIV infection, where we still think a lot of infections are happening, and we want people to get on treatment as quickly as possible. And finally, another research, and Ruve is smiling. So this is in planning, and we're excited about being able to do this in collaboration with PEPFAR and NIMH and IAPAC and KEMRI in Kenya, our HIV Center in New York and University of Michigan, to look at identifying individual community structural level factors influencing uptake, use, and patient-centered delivery of HIV testing and care services from the perspective of the populations most at risk in these settings. We're working in both fishing and non-fishing communities. Kenneth Nguri is here somewhere, I believe, who is one of our partners in Kenya. We will be doing in-depth interviews with these three populations, as well as focus groups with providers and stakeholders. So I want to wrap up and say that I think you get a sense, the reason I talked about some of the research I'm involved in, is that I think it fits in the kind of work that Gary and Andy would do, the kind of work that a lot of you do. If we're remembering the individual involved behind the epidemic, I always feel like the research that I do has to be community-based, clinic-based. I want to end with a fairly quick, but atypical case study that the reason I'm presenting this is because it shows a little bit of the history of the epidemic I just talked about. So this is a young gay male in his early 20s who moved to New York City to attend graduate school. Actually returned to New York City because he originally was from the city, but moved to Manhattan to go to graduate school. In 1977, he volunteered in the New York Blood Center Hepatitis B efficacy vaccine trial. This was a trial, those of you who know hepatitis B, the vaccine was developed. Gay men were at high risk for getting it. So this cohort was people who were hepatitis B negative, young gay men, and it was a phase 3 trial. It was a successful trial. But what happened, this started in the 70s and went to the 80s with the epidemic hit, and it hit New York City very hard. So in 1984, this person discovered, invited the cohort to continue in an ongoing natural history study of HIV, because they had people who were infected, people who weren't infected. So in 1984, this person discovered that he was HIV positive. This was before the test was commercially available. They were giving results to participants if they wanted them. And that his infection actually dated back to 1980. So it was infected before we even knew about the epidemic. And in the 1990s, he was fortunate to have been labeled a long-term non-progressor, and was moved into a study at the Aaron Diamond Institute, ended up being one of 10 cases that were written up in this New England Journal of Medicine article about what's behind long-term non-progression. People who are living at this point, it was 10 plus years without any sign of immune decline. And even in some of these cases, they couldn't even find much of the virus or the virus in the body. However, after 20 years of being a non-progressor, the researchers saw a rising viral load, a decline in CD4 cells. And David Ho and Marty Markowitz recommended very strongly this person should go on medication. This person was highly resistant. This person actually got involved in AIDS work and attended a lot of the AIDS conferences and was aware of the toxicities and things like lipodystrophy and a lot of fears and concerns. I see a reaction from Moises. You remember these days. It took time. And the reason I'm highlighting this is Mara Guads actually talked about this in some of her research yesterday, we're all supportive of immediate treatment, immediate ART for people. But some people will take time. There are a lot of reasons why people need to personally come to that place and be motivated to initiate treatment. So, for those of you who haven't already guessed, this case is me. And I'm proud to stand here and say that after 36 years of living with HIV, while recognizing the privilege I had of having access to researchers and good medical care, still, I know that there's a process of accepting treatment, thinking about it, and being ready to adhere. I'm pleased to say that I've been highly adherent once I did decide to go on treatment. And I was fortunate by biology, and also that this was post-1996, that I didn't need medication for 20 years. But if it wasn't for the compassion and caring concern of providers that I worked with and my primary care provider, as well as friends and family, I would not be standing here addressing you today. Sorry. So I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to deliver this lecture, particularly Jose again, Reve, and Mike, mugs. Thank you, Carol, for your gracious introduction. I want to thank all the patients in the past panels in my practice, the providers who treated them, all the early pioneers and activists, including Gary and Andy, all that they have taught us and taught me. You see a list of people here who I want to personally thank for having contributed to and inspired this talk. Thank you, the audience, for your time, for your attention. And hyper hope, can we end AIDS? I'm an optimist. I've always been an optimist. But I think it's going to be a lot of hard work if we work together with humanity, with compassion, with quality care for all the people worldwide who need treatment and people living with HIV. Thank you.